Spinelli's path stretched into the darkened thicket, past a choir of singing insects, toward the sound of flowing water and croaking frogs. He opened his cell phone, punched up the gain on the screen, and tried using it to light the way. No good. Beyond a few inches, the screen's unfocused glow dissipated into complete darkness. What about the flash? A quick look around was all he needed to get his bearings. He raised the phone, held it toward the creek, and snapped the shutter. The LED pulsed, illuminating the trail. In that instant, he saw the path curving toward the creek, stepping stones dotting the water, and, on the far bank, the shadow of something crouching just beyond the limits of the light. The image lingered, repeating as he blinked his eyes. Was it a man? Spinelli blinked again. The image returned, dimmer this time, looking less like a man and more like a wedge of shale. Either way, it hadn't been there the last time he'd passed through. Was he in the right place? He turned the phone toward him, looking at the picture. On the small LCD screen, the shape looked even less distinct. Perhaps it was nothing at all. But just in case, he called into the darkness, keeping his voice calm, non-threatening. "Hey, I'm coming through." It occurred to him that the figure might be a Winslow derelict, and homeless people could be violently territorial. "Don't want your campsite, man. I'm just passing through, okay?" No answer. He advanced again, raised the phone, and checked his position with another LED pulse. The stepping stones flashed back into view. He walked out onto the first one, paused, hit the flash again. The shadow on the far bank seemed to have moved. "It's nothing," he told himself, advancing to the next stone. "Just a change in perspective." But when he turned the phone to check the screen, he saw a clearly defined figure that appeared to be neither man nor rock. And the angle of that shot, he had held the phone higher this time, revealed a new detail, a face peering back at him from the tiny screen, two glowing eyes looking around the curve of a winged shoulder. He heard it moving now, shuffling through the weeds less than 20 feet away. It sounded huge, not man, not stone, but some gigantic animal moving forward to have a look at him. He turned to run, a blast of wind striking his shoulders before he reached the next stone. The gust threw him forward. He lost balance, slipped on a patch of moss, and landed in the creek. The cell phone flew from his hand, and the next thing he knew, he was leaning back with his palms in the muddy bottom, looking at a winged shape hurtling straight up beyond the thicket's tangled branches. He saw it for less than a second, then it arched out of view, leaving him alone with the trill of insects and frogs and something else, the sound of a Mustang advancing along Winslow Road. He got up, sloshed through the water, and pulled himself through a wall of ferns, vines, and sumac. Panic rose as he struggled to find the trail, and in that panic he recalled the look of the thing he had seen silhouetted against the sky. Maybe his impression would change after he had made it to the bank and got back into the light, when he had time to reflect and rationalize about what he had just seen. But now, surrounded by dark undergrowth and struggling to make his way to the pickup point on Winslow Road, he could not shake the absolute certainty that the creature he had seen arcing through the darkness had been that of a gigantic winged man.
Today we are happy to welcome Lawrence Conley, a writer of science fiction, fantasy, horror, and other genres, to our show and talk to him about the writing he does, how he comes up with some of the ideas, and some of the things that he's got planned for the future. Welcome, Mr. Conley.
Welcome. Glad to be here.
Here's the first question that so many people get asked that you're probably tired of hearing it, but I'm sure that it's particularly pertinent for somebody in your field of fantasy, science fiction, and horror. What is it? Where do your stories come from? Are these nightmares of yours that you're just getting onto paper to get them out of your mind? Or are they things that you've sat down to think about all the what-ifs and what if things go really wrong?
You know, that's something I actually never get tired of talking about. I know that that is the question that a lot of writers talk about, that they dread. And I think the reason so many writers dread that question is simply because they hear it so often, and because the answer to it is just, you know, so much a part of what we do constantly. We are always turning over ideas in our mind. We're always playing with what-ifs, and it becomes second nature to us. And so it's difficult for us then to, you know, kind of turn the mirror back on this activity that we do second nature and try to analyze it. But I can tell you that you mentioned dreams, and certainly dreams are an important inspiration. They go back, certainly Mary Shelley got the idea for Frankenstein from a dream. Horace Walpole, the author of the first haunted house story, not a particularly good story, but wrote The Castle of Otranto, and it was based on a dream that he had. We have the Kubla Khan, the great poem by Coleridge, also inspired by a dream. And so this has happened over and over again, that writers have had dreams that have profoundly moved them, and they've awakened from the dream and sat down and began to write. And this has happened a few times with the stories I've written. There was a story about 10 years ago in Thomas Monteleone's collection called Borderlands. And the story in that, that's actually a book, the story in that book was Traumatic Descent. And the story was just kind of a feeling of a dream. I woke from a sense of a person being in a doctor's waiting room and being very confused and anxious. And it wasn't so much that there was any image there, but it was just that feeling of being anxious and confused in a doctor's waiting room, an experience that many readers would certainly be able to identify with. You know, people are often anxious in doctor's waiting rooms. So I awoke and I tried to put this into the framework of a plot, the framework of a story. And as I worked on it, it began to take on much more substance than the dream ever had. But what I ended up with, or tried to end up with, was something that would have the structure of story, but the foreboding, the intangible fear of a dream. And it must have worked, because a few years after the story came out, a couple of filmmakers from England, Charlie Cantor and David Slade. David is now working in Hollywood. His film Hard Candy came out last year, and this year he's bringing out 30 Days of Night, which is due to open in October. And they had seen the story, and it had moved them so much that they decided to option it. And it has been under option for quite a few years. It hasn't been made. But I use that story just as a way of saying how, something that is inspired by those dark regions that we all have can sometimes, if we can work them into our stories, can communicate on a kind of a visceral, unconscious level with people well enough that they will be moved by the story, may even be willing to spend a great deal of money to procure the rights of that story. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in using dreams as the inspiration for works. But more often than not, I have to tell you, it's just a very conscious effort. I'll sit around and I'll play with what-ifs and I'll see where they lead. But oftentimes, whether I'm playing with a what-if or if I'm playing with a dream, by the time I'm done, it's profoundly different from the thing I started with.
You know, it's really interesting you're using the term moved by a story. And it's the first time I've thought of sci-fi or horror as a genre that moves people. I usually think of that as, moved to tears or something like that. But especially in horror, I guess there was a literal movement if you're jumping out of your seat or something like that, that I think that's a really interesting connection that I hadn't made before.
Yes, and of course, also just moved to wonder. You know, the movement, the eyes opening, the jaw dropping. This is what we often try to go. We often try for in science fiction is that gasp of wonder. And in horror, it's the gasp of horror. Fantasy, it can actually go either way, but more often than not, fantasy has the same gasp of wonder that you get in science fiction. The only difference is that in science fiction, there's that gasp, and the reader says, "Oh my gosh, that could be." And in fantasy, it's there's the gasp, and then it's oh my, what if it were so? But it is. We do have a physical response to our emotions, emotion and motion, carefully aligned.
Yeah, it's going on that same thought. I've often, as I was reading some of your stuff, I was thinking about the suspension of disbelief and going with the emotion. And what kind of limits do you place on yourself? The horror fiction that I read from yours wasn't particularly a splatterfest. And maybe you have stories like that, but how do you keep yourself from going too far? Do you think you can go too far? I mean, for me, movies, I like some horror, but movies like Saw kind of put me off a little bit. I'm not as interested in seeing that as something that's more, maybe a little bit more psychological or something like that. What's your take on your boundaries for sci-fi or horror, things like that?
Yes, I do try to pull back from that as much as possible. I do not go for the gross out, or I should say I rarely go for the gross out. I think, as the Greeks believed, that a death off stage can be far more effective and dramatic than one on stage. And this is not to say that I do not, in the stories that I write, have deaths on stage. I do, but I try to present them in a way that does not have the gross out as being its primary goal. Now, yes, the stories that we're talking about here echoes the short story that came out in Twilight Zone magazine back in 1983 and has been in print ever since. It's been anthologized and re-anthologized and actually made into two short films, one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast. This has a death, or death occurs off even before the story begins. The story begins after death, and we have a character, living woman, Marie, who is coming to terms with this. So we never see the accident, although the accident is alluded to. There's a car accident there. Interestingly, when the film was shot in Hollywood, and again, shot as a short film, the only way anyone is going to see this is if one attends art festivals and such, but this opened with the car accident and with the aftermath of the car accident, but the story did not. The other stories that we have we have on the table or in front of us right now, Beowulf, which is a humorous retelling of Beowulf. Nobody dies. What a change that is from Beowulf, where there's so much blood and mayhem. And
I want to go on record as saying I wasn't going to tell anybody when we discussed this story what it was a retelling of.
Yes.
Because I thought, I'm going to give away something here, and I didn't want to do that.
Oh no, I actually think that's some of the fun of it is knowing that it's retelling of Beowulf. Hey, I'll let you in on something. This is I'll give something else away, something that really doesn't occur to people when they read it. But the story that just came out in fantasy and science fiction, Daughters of Prime, which was out in the July 07 issue of Fantasy and Science Fiction. Believe it or not, that one is also inspired by Beowulf. And
really?
Yes, and of course, now when you think about it, we have the monster that comes out of the forest and plagues the village, and the hero comes and not to give too much away, but the hero seems to come right at the nick of time. I think Karagama in Daughters of Prime is a little more three-dimensional than Beowulf is, and she has more doubts than he has. But nevertheless, she is that Beowulf-type character in that story. Now, here's the thing, though. There are more stories coming after Daughters of Prime. Daughters of Prime is the first of a series of stories, and when you begin to put all the stories together, you'll see more and more of the similarities between that and Beowulf. But yes, not a whole lot of on-stage death, although there's the threat of it in Daughters of Prime. So you're correct. In my work, there more often than not is the death occurs offstage, or the death occurs without gratuitous violence.
I didn't get the Beowulf in the second one. I didn't think about it that way, but I was thinking about it as I was struck with it as kind of a reworking of like Christian symbology with maybe a bow towards Joan of Arc.
Yes.
In the way that she's just sort of jousting with it and the weapon that she's using. I was looking for it and I couldn't find it. I thought it was, you described it as, well, there was corkscrew, but there was also sort of cruciform.
Yes.
or something like that, that I thought that it was, oh, you know, that you might be working with, you know, religious themes. And I was wondering if that was part of it. See, now I'm trying to figure out your psychological state as you're writing the stories.
Yes, much. Very much a story that does have some religious iconography in it. And that, too, in a way, inspired by Beowulf, which, you know, we have the monk's hand, the 11th century monk, as he's transcribing Beowulf. He's putting all of these, you know, religious overtones, Christian overtones into it. And so that was me including a few of those for the reader to find. But yes, mm-hmm. you're right. The corkscrew, the core sampler that Kara uses to draw core samples from the ground on the planet that she is studying, that is a cruciform structure, and that cruciform shape is apparent when she uses it to mark the grave of her predecessor, and the shadow shines on the grave, shines on the mm-hmm. Karen that she has made. So, yes, good eye. That's very much part of Daughters of Prime.
Well, you seem to, and this is probably has everything to do with working in a particular genre like fantasy. You know, you're spoofing some of these things, like you said with Beowulf. And I take it this is an area you have a particular interest in, or did you think the time had finally come to poke fun at medieval texts, which has enough time gone by that we can make fun of some of the excesses of Beowulf, which I talked to somebody, an English major. I asked her to read some of the stories and give me some of her feedback, because I'm always interested in you know, how other people are responding to the same kind of story that I'm reading. And she said, I thought it was more fun to read than Beowulf. So, you know, is it because of simply because of the kind of working in this genre, or is medieval fiction, wait a minute, I can't call it fiction, are medieval texts an area of particular interest?
I am interested in them. As a fantasy writer, I do get inspiration from medieval text. I feel in some ways as if I'm carrying on the tradition that the writers and storytellers of medieval times were carrying. You see, the work that we do today that's called fantasy, it used to be the only literature there was. You know, when you look back at the stories of the past, Beowulf, the Odyssey, the Iliad, I mean, these are fantastic stories. And if you look at some of the great classics, their works that we call classics today, Hamlet, Macbeth, you know, they all have this element of the fantastic in them. And it's only today that we really think of these kinds of stories as being labeled fantasy. But this is the mainstream literature of the past. But I do like to know what my predecessors have done. And sometimes, as in Beowulf or Daughters of Prime, I do feel moved to go deep into that well and you know, and drink from the same draught that they drank from. It's good inspiration.
You know, and while we're talking about, you know, genre and writing in a particular form, writing, drawing inspiration from the past, many years ago, Kurt Vonnegut, one of my favorite authors, discussed the problematic critical reception of, in his case, science fiction, saying that the category was too often confused with a urinal.
Yes.
do you think this is changed with modern science fiction or horror? I mean, it seems to me that, I'll tip my hand a little bit here, that Stephen King, for example, is getting a lot better critical reception now than in the past, and that there are other authors that seem to be getting you know, a little bit better take, because I think people are sort of recognizing some of the things that you're talking about how, you know, these are things that aren't simply, you know, you use them for fun and never think about them, but the things that are sort of representative in obviously exaggerated forms, but of real issues, and I'm wondering what's your take on that?
Well, you see, the problem is that there's so much of it, and any given month, you know, there'll be, I don't know the number, but there'll be many, many works of fiction published in the science fiction genre, the fantasy genre. And in a given year, you know, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of books and hundreds of short stories all coming out. And I'm talking about the professional press. I'm not even talking about the small press. So there's so much that comes out in a given year. And, you know, most of it is just not going to be that good. But every year, there are gems that come out, you know, magnificent pieces of work that those people who are taking the time to read all that comes out or read much of what comes out, or those who have a sense of what to look for and how to recognize the gems, there are great works that are coming out that oftentimes aren't recognized by the masses until we've had time to sift through all of this stuff, and then the people who have done all of the reading will do the recommendations, and then over the years, the good stuff gets recommended, and it wins awards, and it is reprinted, and so eventually we end up with this sense that you've used the example of Stephen King. Eventually, we end up with the sense that Stephen King has done some great works, and he absolutely has. He's done some magnificent pieces of work. The Body, for example, magnificent story that was made into the film Stand By Me. I think, you know, just one of the great American short stories novellas is The Body by Stephen King. And certainly The Shining, one of the best haunted house stories ever written, and best vampire novel, certainly in my, you know, from my point of view, it's Salem's Lot. So these are the ones we remember, and we do kindly forget the missteps. But when the misstep is out, when it's fresh, that's what people are paying attention to. And when there's a lot of these being published together, people are paying attention to them, so that there's a sense that, you know, from moment to moment, there's a lot of not very good stuff out there. And I think that that's a fair assessment. It was Theodore Sturgeon who said that 90% or 95% of anything is crude. And same goes with science fiction and fantasy literature. But boy, mm-hmm. oh boy, that quintessence that we find on the top, the creme de la creme, it really is about the best there is. And and I think for that reason, since there is now enough of this, enough of the excellent novels and stories that have been written in these genres over the past decades, that people are beginning to realize that, yes, there are gems, and they do deserve critical recognition.
And I've heard that there's a popular series of books about a wizard or something that's also making waves.
Yeah.
By a British guy, a British boy, Potter or something like
that's
that.
Right.
That's also being well received and took up a little bit of my summer.
Yes.
This year.
Can you imagine books that are that difficult to put down? I mean, what mastery this is! Bookstores when the last book in the Potter series came out, lines forming and people walking out of the store reading the book, and people warning one another: you get to this page, you better be prepared to finish because you're not going to be able to stop. This is great discussions to have about books, and the very first thing that a book has to do is it has to grab the audience, and if it does that, then it can go on and do all the more cerebral things that a book needs to do. But my goodness, what we witnessed when this last Potter book came out was just incredible. Reading is still very much a part of our world, and it's still something that people really enjoy doing. When something terrific comes out, people honor it, recognize it.
And I remember grilling dinner and trying to read the book at the same time and recognizing that I hadn't done that in a long time, maybe really ever. But it puts me in mind of a lot of the stories about when Dickens' stories came out and the kind of fanfare that accompanied a lot of what he did. And, you know, maybe she's this generation's Dickens. That's, I guess, not really for this generation to decide. But it will be really interesting, you know, and my great-grandchildren will be looking at an old J.K. Rowling book saying, oh, look at this. It's like, you know, it's just like Dickens or something like that.
And, you know, I think they will be looking at a book, too. I certainly recognize that there's going to be many changes in technology, and there are many changes in technology going on right now. But there still seems to be that attraction to the book. There is something that the technology of the book just does so well. It's the sort of thing that you can walk out of a bookstore turning the pages, you know, reading as you walk. I think it is something that's going to be with us for quite some time. And this is, I just wanted to underscore what you said. Yes, our grandchildren will be reading Harry Potter books in the future.
And I don't know if you're familiar with Sven Burkitt's and the Gutenberg elegies, but he's making that case very much as well. I have a lot of interest in technology, but you know, I've also got a house full of books. He tells a story about somebody who was an academic who was selling all his books because he said, you know, the web is the future, and I haven't seen that yet. That doesn't obviously preclude it, but you know, it's something I notice as my kids are coming home from school. Then my daughter keeps bringing home library books and everything. She hasn't brought home, you know, the library book reader yet, you know, or one of those handheld things. Maybe
right.
She's not going to the right school, but that's, you know, that's the thing. What, as somebody who has, I mostly write academic things that really no one reads, but what is, I'm always interested in somebody who's writing as much as you are. What's your writing schedule and how do you get yourself to stick to it?
Well, you know, after a while, there really is no problem sticking to it. The hard part is when you're first getting started and in setting up that schedule. But like anything else, if you can find a way to incorporate the writing into your life, if you can develop a writing life or a writer's life, it becomes such an important part of your life that you can't not do it. And so my schedule is such that I will write in the evenings. I do have an academic position, and I never write in the office. There's something that I cannot do. I cannot mix writing with any other activity, because once I go into that zone of writing, I am gone. And it actually takes a bit of a transition from when I stop writing, stop working on something for the day, and can reintegrate myself back into life. So I have an office at home, and it's walled in books, and I have the desk in the middle, and the computer is set up there. And I'll go in there and just go to work. Work a couple of hours each night. And then on the weekends, pretty much get the whole day, Saturday, working on whatever it is that I'm working on. The nice thing about an academic career is I do have the break times. I do have the summer times. And certainly for an academic, that's the time when we pursue professionally that subject that we teach academically. You know, that's when we you know, sound the depths of what we profess. And so the summertime, I will often spend 10, maybe 12 hours a day writing. I have found that the middle part of the day is often a dead time, a time when I might go out and sweep the garage or do something else, because I find myself maybe between 1 and 4, not really coming up with anything. But then the evening starts to fall, things really kick into high gear. I'll work until about 10 o'clock at night, and then I'll go out for a walk, and then I'll come back home and read a book or put on a DVD. But that's my pace, and it is a daily effort. And when things happen, as they often do, and I have to choose between writing and something else, I'll choose the writing. When I can't choose and I have to do the other thing, I will, you know, maybe get irritable. I'll find I'm not thinking as clearly. I find that writing really helps keep things on an even keel, helps me keep things in perspective. And it's an important part of the life, such an important part of the life that I just don't think I have the option not to do it anymore. I'll say one more thing about that. It's important that writers early on, whenever they begin their career, whether they begin it in their teens or their 20s, I began in my 20s, or whether they begin in midlife, that they really make it clear to the people in their lives that this is important, this is something I wish to do, I wish you will support, hope you will support me on it, and if you can let the people in your world appreciate that, they will honor that, and they will give you the space and the time that you need to write. If you don't establish that, then you know, people will always interrupt you. People will think nothing of interrupting a person while he's writing or a person while he's reading. People would probably think twice before interrupting a person who's having a conversation. But somehow, people don't always see writing and reading as being conversation.
I have a 5-year-old and 8-year-old, and right now they don't recognize anything as something you don't interrupt. But I get your point. Bleeding might be the one thing that they don't interrupt. You know, when you're just to bring it into a horror vein, when you're writing, what kind of audience do you have in mind? Do you have are you writing for yourself? Are you writing for like some kind of audience that you've assembled through the years? Do you populate it, or does it not even enter into your mind? You're just thinking story, character development, things like that. I ask because when I teach, at Ohio State, I try to get people to think about their audience. A lot of the stuff I teach is, technical professional kind of writing, and I want them to think, you know, how is this going to be received? So maybe it's a question that you can take and move in a couple different directions, but I'm curious about what you think of as how your work is going to be received. Do you give it to somebody else, or do you have a construct in your mind of who your reader is?
Yeah, so try to be very much aware that there is a reader, always thinking of the reader. I don't have a specific person in mind, don't have a specific kind of person in mind, but, you know, every line has got to stand on its own without me there to explain what I mean. And so I'm always trying to be aware of how a person would understand the line that I write. I will tell you this. I do not have any audience for any of my work until it's finished. I almost never show anything in progress to anybody. And this goes back to when I was starting out, and I started doing this in the late 70s, early 80s, and I was just not aware of any writers' groups or you know, aware that a person could perhaps major in creative writing, and really had to find my own way. But I found that it works best. I really think that the writer needs to have autonomy until the work is finished. And then I think it should only be shared with the editor first. I'm against, you know, taking a finished work and showing it to friends. You know, if this is for a professional writer now, of course. I think that a professional writer just needs to give it to his editor, and the editor is either going to write a check or the editor is going to ask for revisions. So I suppose, in a roundabout way, what I've you know, said in this answer is that even though I don't have any specific person in mind when I'm writing, the goal really is to have something to submit to a professional editor. And knowing what the professional editor is looking for, or what the professional editors in the field are looking for at any given time, is something that comes from reading the magazines and books that are being published now, and also studying the market guidelines to some extent, and going to the conventions, going to the science fiction, horror, and fantasy conventions, and meeting the editors and dialoguing with them. So who's my audience? First, it's the editor, I guess, and then beyond that, it's the general reader, and I sure hope I'm communicating effectively with that general reader.
You know, that's a great comment, because I just did we had a podcast from a well-published academic writer who gave a lot of really great advice, and some of his advice was, you know, get to know the editors, get to into a conversation with them, talk to them, find out what they're interested in, because, you know, you can like very well what you've written. And I know that everything I've written is pure genius and brilliant, but the editor may not feel that way. So it's something that I think is a really great idea. And, you know, I've engaged a little bit more in that. I don't claim to do it nearly as much as I probably should, mostly because my job is administrative. So I don't do as much writing as I might otherwise. Tell me about, you said you didn't show it to anybody until it was done. What constitutes done with a story for you? I mean, one of the principal and probably problematic dictums I have for writing is you're never done with it. You just run out of time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very true. And, you know, there comes a point where we have to, you know, abandon the work to public recognition. You know, it has to be turned in. And when something comes out, oftentimes I'll look at it on the page and say, you know, I could have done that this way. And there's always the second guessing, but we do have to be willing to turn the work in and let it stand on its own. So I think I've gotten away from the question, though. The original question was, when do you know that it's complete? When do you know that it's finished or ready to be submitted?
Right.
And I found that... this is relatively new, I guess. Maybe the last, 7-8 years as I'm working on this. I really do know. If I have something, I've been working on it for a few weeks, if it's a short story, and, I want it to be done, but I don't feel it's done. Generally, that feeling is right. It's not finished. There's something wrong with it. There's something that can be better. And yet when I reach a point, when I say, you know, this is it, by golly, I got it, and I send it out, and the editor will either confirm that or ask for a rewrite. But I'm finding that more often than not, I can trust that feeling. When I feel that, it's probably going to sell. And when I don't feel that, I might tell myself it's okay. I might tell myself it's good enough. But more often than not, it'll come back for rewrites. But this is not something that that you have instantly. This is something that you have to cultivate as a writer makes sales. A writer, begins to develop a track record. A writer also begins to develop a sense of what his or her best stuff is. Now, I know when I was first starting out, I didn't really have much sense of what was good and what wasn't working. And back then, most of the stuff came back, not for rewrites, but most of the stuff just bounced back. But the few things that did come back, when the editor requested a rewrite, I always made sure I listened to the editor, did what he or she asked me to do, and that's how I learned, really, what constitutes a finished piece of work.
You know, your readers come at your work from a variety of different backgrounds, maybe more than in other areas. And this kind of goes back to, this is another audience question, I guess. But what kind of considerations do you have when you're trying to balance that? I know you said that you didn't have a particular audience, but have you ever written anything and you thought, oh, this may be too technical for this particular sci-fi? Because there are some, this may be an older division, but there was a sort of division of soft science fiction and hard science fiction where people that got more into the hardware versus, people that had more of an interest in sort of societal relations in the future. I think Ursula K. Le Guin kind of gets, I think she's supposed to be more on the soft, although I don't know that I hold to those designations. I think she's a fantastic writer, but was. So I'm wondering, how do you balance that? Is that not a consideration or something that you're, looking at a specific magazine and thinking, oh, I can go further in this particular direction because of the readership that I want to look at in here, as opposed to something else?
So I'm just trying to get a handle on this one. How do I know what I can do?
Right. How do you balance it for a particular? You're probably aiming at if you're writing science fiction, you may have a particular journal in mind for it, or you get done and you think, oh, this would work particularly well. Do you ever go back and edit for that kind of that particular journal and think this would be better off if I left, you know, the description of this out or added some more like this so that you're tailoring it more, I guess is my question.
Yes, I think so. I think that that's very much the case. If I'm starting out working on something and it begins to take shape and I begin to feel that this would be a good story for the magazine of fantasy and science fiction or this would be a good story for a horror magazine, then I will begin to think of where I will be sending it specifically and what the things that particular editor and readership like. And so I will begin to work the story so that it fits the guidelines or fits the expectations of that editor and that readership. And I realize as I say this that I am coming back to that question, who is your reader? And just answering your questions here is helping me clarify these things that I frankly don't often think about that often. They do become second nature. But yes, even though I might not begin with a clear reader or clear editor in mind, as the story starts to take shape, I begin to develop a sense of where it will go. And then I do tend to begin to write for that specific editor and that specific readership. Now, there are other times when a story is commissioned, however, and I know right from the beginning not only who's going to be reading it, but what the story has to be about. I just finished a story. It's a great, great anthology coming out from PS Publishing, which is a British company that is helmed by Peter Crowther. And they just put out some remarkable stuff. And this is an anthology called Darkness on the Edge. And it, believe it or not, it's an anthology of stories inspired by the music of Bruce Springsteen. So I knew from the very beginning that I was writing for this particular editor. Harrison Howell was the editor of this anthology, is the editor of this anthology. And I knew I was writing for people who are Bruce Springsteen fans and horror fans. And I knew that my story had to be about or inspired by Springsteen's song, Murder Incorporated. So I knew a lot of stuff going into this one. And when I'm writing for the theme anthologies, that's often the way I approach it. So again, returning to that question, who is your reader when you're writing? If I'm writing for a theme anthology, then I generally know from the beginning who I'm writing for and what I'm writing about and how far I can go. Beowulf was written pretty much on consignment, you know, or on commission. I was commissioned to do that one. And when I began to write, I knew that that Will Horner at Fantasist Enterprises was going to be reading and purchasing that story, and I knew that the readers of this line of fantasy books was going to be reading it. So when I'm writing for the theme anthology, I know pretty much who they are and how far I can go and what I can and can't do. And I guess the last thing I would say about that is in the Beowulf book, which is called Bash Down the Door and Slice Open the Bad Guy, that title, it better be humorous with that title. And I knew that it had to be PG-13. He really wanted to keep it humorous and light and not too graphic. And so I knew where the boundaries were. When I'm writing a story that I think I'm going to submit to Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, I know that it's pretty much open. I can try a lot of different things if I'm going to be sending a story to that magazine. It better be good. That's one of the top magazines in the field. But as far as taboos, I don't really think of those kind of lines when I'm writing for that magazine.
Okay. Not to circle back around too much, but I'm a big Springsteen fan. Was just out of curiosity, was he involved in the creation of this? He gave it his blessing, or it didn't matter?
That's a good question. When it comes down to work inspired by other works, things are pretty wide open. It certainly changes if you're going to be quoting from that work, if you're going to be really basing your plot on that work. But the idea of this anthology, Darkness on the Edge, I'm really excited about this one. I've read some of the writers who are going to be writing for it, and it looks like it's going to be a terrific book. The basic premise is this. You could put on a Bruce Springsteen CD and read along, and the music would fit the tone of what you're reading, but you're not going to be reading a dramatization of the words of the song. Pretty neat concept, but it's going to be a heck of a good book.
Well, that gives me the inspiration to maybe tonight I'll write Beowulf, right, the ballad, or Daughters of Prime, the pop song. Or something.
I was thinking about that. I was thinking that what we need is a good song about Grendel. I haven't been able to find one.
Yeah, you don't get a lot. It's probably because it may be hard to rhyme. I can't come up with any rhymes for Grendel at the moment. Bendel.
Yeah.
Do not fold, spindle.
That's pretty good.
Mutilate. Any of those old, that probably doesn't get printed on anything anymore, the way it used to on the old computer cards. What this is, maybe as a way of closing, one of my, questions that I like to ask people who are writing: what does writing or telling a story accomplish for you? What does it feed?
It gives the opportunity. It gives the writer the opportunity to work with those elements that are central to human consciousness. I hope I'm not getting too cerebral here, but we work with words. A carpenter works with wood. Lighting designer works with lights. Musician works with musical instruments. But we work with the intangibles, don't we? I mean, we work with the stuff of ideas, and I find that when we work with this stuff, it's certainly rewarding in its own right, but it gives us, I think, the ability to think and to comprehend the world with a kind of clarity that I'm not sure that people who don't spend their lives working with words and concepts get the opportunity to do. I just don't think that that you can really perceive the world clearly unless you have really been able to work in the realm of ideas and words. And I think that for me, is one of the best spin-offs or benefits from writing. But the more direct ones, certainly, I can't imagine anything more thrilling. It's still thrilling after all these years. You go down to the bookstore and pick up the new magazine and there's my words, there's my story, there's my character, and she's living in these pages, and people are reading about her, and she's becoming part of their consciousness. This is thrilling stuff. And it's nice to be able, after all of so many years, I've been at this for 3 decades. It's nice to actually sit back occasionally and look back at the stories and to think that these are out there and they're living on their own, and they're living in people's minds, and there are people out there that I've never met and I'll never meet them, but they know my characters and they know my characters' thoughts. And it's a nice way of plugging into the world. I don't know if there's a better way to do it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
I really appreciate your
time. Thank you so much. Good talking to you.